Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. First off, happy birthday to Bilbo and Frodo Baggins. And yes, everyone who listens to this program probably knows I'm an avid... I love reading in general, but I'm also an avid fan of the works of Lewis and Tolkien and Chesterton. And because of that, I remember that September the 22nd is, in fact, the birthday that J.R.R. Tolkien attributed to Frodo Baggins and Bilbo Baggins. It wasn't chosen by chance. It's a date that many people don't seem to think about, but for readers of Tolkien, and for those who know his biblical Catholic sensibilities and worldview, and therefore you know the Catholic imagination behind his world building, you know that every date, every detail, every nuance portrayed in his masterful work of the Lord of the Rings and the Middle Earth works all revolve around some kind of thematic reality, and September the 22nd is no different. It actually mirrors the destruction of the ring. And so I want to unpack all of that for us. I hope that my opening commentary will help us understand that there's a tremendous amount of imagery inside even the selection of this date and the culture of the hobbits, the way they conduct themselves on birthdays, the kind of theological significance even that entails, and how evil becomes a perversion of that selfless act of even celebration and gift. We go on from there to speak with Wes Smith. Noted bioethicist and lawyer Thaddeus Pope has written an essay listing 11 ways people can avoid late-stage dementia, and almost all involve intentionally ending life. He dismisses options like hospice care for imposing a burden on the patient and their family. Wes and I have spoken about problems like this in the past, and we will continue to talk about this because bold Christians must speak out against evil. And then finally, we speak with Stephen White. 15 years ago this month, Benedict XVI became the first pope to make a state visit to Britain. During his visit, he preached on the role of laity and the relationship between faith and reason in Westminster Hall. And lest the great Westminster Hall address be relegated to the footnotes of history, let me remind you, it was significant historically as well as at the time prescient. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, September 22nd. It's the Feast of St. Ignatius. Today's news brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. Tens of thousands flocked to the State Farm Stadium in Glendale, Arizona on Sunday to honor the late Christian and conservative activist Charlie Kirk. The 31-year-old Turning Point USA founder was assassinated earlier this month while speaking on a college campus in Utah. In her address, his widow, Erica Kirk, expressing forgiveness for the shooter.
That man, that young man, I forgive him.
Other speakers included Vice President Vance and President Trump himself. Spirit Airlines plans to furlough one-third of its flight attendants in a cost-cutting move.
That's according to the Wall Street Journal, which cited a message sent by the COO to employees. The executive told employees the airline needs to shift its focus to a complete right-sizing. The decision comes after Spirit revealed to employees last week that it plans to reduce flight capacity by 25% in November. It also follows Spirit filing for bankruptcy for the second time in less than a year last month. I'm Monica Nelson.
TikTok's algorithm will be operated by Oracle in the U.S. if a deal with China is finalized. The deal would see Oracle take control of the domestic operations as well. The federal government will not take an equity stake in the social media platform. Lawyers for Google and the Justice Department will return to a federal courthouse in Virginia for a roughly two-week try on how to restore the competition to the advertising technology markets that Google monopolized. This comes weeks after a D.C. District Court judge issued a historic ruling deeming Google a monopoly in online search. From your AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Vita. September the 22nd. It's a date that most pass by with very little reflection, but for readers of Tolkien, especially for those of us who know the Catholic imagination behind his work, today carries a depth of meaning far beyond the birthdays of two fictional hobbits, because it's on this day that both Bilbo and Frodo, their central figures in The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings, were born. Tolkien never left anything of great significance to chance. He intentionally placed their birthdays on the date of the traditional autumn equinox. This wasn't merely a convenient date. Now, he might not himself have made statements to this effect, but the parallels are too consistent and convenient, in fact, to ignore. Because the equinox, especially for Christian history, carries with it a symbolic rhythm in salvation history. It's tied to biblical typology, Catholic liturgical tradition, and so to understand this, we have to see how September 22nd mirrors its counterpart, which is the spring equinox, March the 25th, which is the traditional date of both the Annunciation and the Crucifixion. In Tolkien's mythology, the destruction of the One Ring coincides on that day. In the Catholic imagination, the two equinoxes then function as parallel markers of divine balance in the natural sphere, turning points where heaven and earth meet in decisive spiritual struggle against God and the evil that plagues mankind. The autumn equinox was long linked to the Christian calendar to Michaelmas. This is the feast of St. Michael the Archangel. The feast celebrates Michael's triumph over the fallen angel Lucifer. This is an exalted seraph who sought to exalt himself before God. If you know anything about your angelology, according to the book of the Revelation, Michael and his angels fought against the dragon and his angels fought, but they were defeated and there was no longer any place for them in heaven. Revelation 12, 7-8. The irony of God's victory also lies in the fact that Michael was not a seraph. The seraphim is the highest order of angels. Michael is an archangel, which belongs to one of the lowest hierarchies. He's in the first triad. God, in his wisdom, willed to exalt the lowly so as to cast down the proud, even in the angelic order. One of the lowest hierarchies is chosen to overthrow the one who thought himself the highest. This dynamic mirrors the role of hobbits in Middle-earth. They are small, unassuming, seemingly inconsequential. And so on this, the feast day of Michaelmas, it is through the hobbits, whose birthdays are celebrated on this day, that the great powers of evil are undone. Just as Michael, the archangel, defeats Lucifer, the seraph, so hobbits, the simplest of Middle-earth creatures, become the instruments of destroying Sauron, a fallen Maya of immense spiritual might. Tolkien's a devout Catholic. He made these parallels intentionally. He understood divine providence always works through the lowly to confound the mighty. Bilbo and Frodo's birthdays also carry significance in their communal and theological context. In hobbit culture, birthdays are not occasions for the self, they're actually opportunities for thanksgiving. The custom is that the one celebrating is the one who distributes gifts to the guests. And this is an acknowledgement of friendship and community. So Bilbo's 11th birthday and his feast is an exaggerated and even comical depiction of this virtue. His generosity is lavish. His desire to give is rooted in the recognition that life and friendship are gifts to be shared. The custom reflects profoundly of a Christian principle. Joy comes from giving, not receiving. It's more blessed to give than to receive. And in a fallen world that's constantly distorting that principle, Tolkien wants to present a clear contrast. This distortion is found most poignantly in the story of Sméagol and Deagol. On his birthday, Deagol discovers the One Ring in the river. Now, this is Sméagol's birthday, of course, like I mentioned, and so Sméagol demands it as his birthday present. Deagol perverts the hobbit custom of generosity into a justification for greed. His desire twists what ought to have been an occasion of gratitude and selflessness into a moment of violence and murder. And so from that moment, Sméagol begins his slow corruption, his steps towards becoming Gollum, enslaved by the ring and cut off from the joy of gift, of community, of selflessness. The tale is a parable of what sin does to the soul. So where Bilbo's birthday feast shows that life is meant to be shared as thanksgiving, Sméagol's birthday murder shows that greed leads only to isolation and misery. The contrast isn't accidental. Tolkien presents in narrative form the gospel truth. True happiness is rooted in self-gift. Selfishness grasps and corrodes the soul. Bilbo is not without his own struggles. His birthday feast becomes the stage for his ultimate test. At the heart of his life is the ring, which he has called my own and even my precious. His attachment reveals a perennial battle against pride and possession. The ring tempts its bearer to claim power and ownership, to center the world on the self. Bilbo's struggle to give it up reflects the universal struggle of fallen man to let go of sinful attachments. With the help of Gandalf's stern intervention, Bilbo surrenders it, but his letting go foreshadows the central theological theme of the story that salvation comes after renunciation, not domination. Bilbo's act of surrender becomes this kind of decisive passing of the burden to Frodo. And Frodo's own birthday, which is his 33rd, also has unmistakable biblical weight. In Jewish tradition, 30 was the age when one could begin public ministry. In Christian memory, 33 is the age of Christ's death. Frodo, stepping into adulthood at 33, is called to bear the great burden of the ring. And that's not a narrative coincidence. Tolkien is drawing a Christological parallel. Frodo's path will be one of suffering, sacrifice, and I guess in a lot of ways apparent defeat, for the sake of the salvation of the entirety of Middle-earth and therefore for others. His 33rd birthday initiates a passion narrative of sorts. It culminates in the ring's destruction on March the 25th, which I mentioned before is the traditional date for both the Annunciation, so the moment the Word became flesh in Mary's womb, but also the day of the crucifixion, it used to be traditionally held, when the Son of God gave his life on the cross. The incarnation and the redemption, the Alpha and the Omega of salvation history, falls on this one date. In Tolkien's mythos, the destruction of the ring on March 25th is no less deliberate. It signifies the undoing of evil by sacrificial love, the triumph of apparent weakness over the powers of darkness. In this light, September the 22nd is not simply a narrative convenience, but a theological counterpart, because the autumn equinox reflects a balance, a turning point, and a preparation for the dark months of winter. In Tolkien's scheme, it signals the beginning of Frodo's burden-wearing, the darkness of his life, the long winter of his passion. So the hobbits, like Michael the Archangel, are exalted precisely because they're lowly. They become the instruments through which the high are cast down. Their birthdays mark not only their personal stories, but also the providential unfolding of divine justice in Tolkien's sub-created world. The Catholic lesson of this entire structure is manifold. God raises up the lowly to humble the proud. He exalts Mary, the humble handmaiden of Nazareth, above the proud of Israel. He makes Michael the instrument of Lucifer's defeat. He chose the hobbits, the smallest of the people, to bring down the great tyrant of Middle-earth. True joy and life are found in giving. Bilbo's generosity contrasts with Gollum's selfishness. It reminds us that every birthday, every gift of life, is an opportunity to give thanks through self-gift. The journey of maturity is inseparable from the embrace of responsibility and suffering. Frodo's 33rd birthday teaches us that to grow into one's full stature is to accept our cross. To live for others is the mark of true adulthood. And so Tolkien's careful choice of dates reminds us, history itself is covenantal, patterned by divine providence. March the 25th and September 22nd are not merely seasonal markers, but liturgical signs, pointing to the victory of Christ and the call for every Christian to share in his triumph through humility, gift, and sacrifice. And so the birthdays of Bilbo and Frodo, far from being quaint details, are part of Tolkien's Catholic imagination. They situate the narrative within the rhythm of salvation history. They show that even in myth, the truths of the gospel are the only real hope for the defeat of evil. And on this day, then, it is fitting to remember not only two hobbits, but also the Feast of Michaelmas, the triumph of the lowly archangel over the proud seraph, the eternal truth that God delights to use the weak to shame the strong. In the end, as Frodo's burden shows and as Christ's cross reveals, salvation comes not from grasping power, but from bearing it, not from domination, but from self-gift and sacrifice. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Resetting your password, unsubscribing from emails, printing anything. Why are simple things sometimes so complicated? Thankfully, with an auto owner's insurance independent agent, getting the right coverage for your business doesn't have to be one of them. So you can get back to more important things, like learning how that printer works. That's simple human sense.
Call Choice Insurance Agency at 734-641-4200.
One person doesn't like the Mona Lisa, the second person does, and the third person says, well, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. It's a popular saying, we know that. Remember, though, that beauty is an element of being. It describes what a thing is. And because it is an element of being, while we talk about beautiful paintings and buildings, we also talk about beautiful persons. We know that Grandma Kuzno is beautiful. We know that our children are beautiful. It even gives us joy to see the cleaning lady in the halls of school because she, too, carries a radiance of beauty. And if someone were to contradict you, if someone were to say, your consideration of Grandma Kuzno's beauty is just your own subjective opinion, we would know that person is wrong. Because beauty is not in the eye of the beholder. It is in my grandmother. It is in my child. GuadalupeWorkers.org.
No one should ever have to choose between feeding their family and keeping their heat on. Impossible questions like rent or diapers demand answers every day, likely in your very own neighborhood. But you can help. Hope Clinic partners with you to provide free medical, dental, food, and behavioral health care, all in Jesus' name. While others face impossible choices, your choice is an easy one. Partner with Hope Clinic today. Find out how at www.thehopeclinic.org.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Ox Peter. Noted bioethicist and lawyer Thaddeus Pope has written an essay listing 11 ways people can avoid late-stage dementia. Almost all involve intentionally ending life, though. None of the steps actually talk about the preservation of life and its dignity. Now, in the essay, he also dismisses options such as hospice care for imposing a burden on the patient and their family. Wes Smith joins us with more. Wes is a part of the Discovery Institute. He left full-time practice of law, and he's now chair and senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism. Wes, so great to speak with you again. How are you?
Marcus, wonderful. Thanks for having me on again.
No, the pleasure is always mine. And I want to open here by talking about this expansion again of the conversation of euthanasia and assisted suicide, because you know that's what society needs. We need to send forth this narrative that as soon as you prove to be even slightly less than fully utilitarian, you serve no purpose.
It really is concerning, because you find the expansion of the killable caste, C-A-S-T-E, mm-hmm. ongoing in an accelerating manner. I mean, it started, we were told it's only for the terminally ill for whom 6 months left to live and nothing else can be done to alleviate suffering. It was never about that, but that was what we were told. Then suddenly we find in countries like Canada, it's also for people with chronic conditions, disabilities, elderly, frail, and so forth. And we're seeing increasing advocacy to open up assisted suicide and even forced starvation, and I'll get into that in a second, mm-hmm. of people who have been diagnosed with dementia if they sign an advance directive, so requesting to be killed once they become incapacitated. I'm thinking of a Down syndrome children who there's a search and destroy mission before birth to keep many of them or most of them from being born. And now it seems to me we're on a search and destroy mission for people who are dependent. And we are telling people who need help that they are burdens and that they need to put themselves out of their loved ones' misery. It really is a crass denial of human dignity, yeah. just as an intrinsic good.
You know, Wes, aside from the very blatant violation of the Hippocratic Oath, which I think you and I have talked about has long since been jettisoned from the practice of Western medicine, the other issue we're seeing is just how callous and cold the narrative has become. It really sounds like they're talking about inanimate material rather than human persons.
And because they're denying they're human persons. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you understand that in utilitarian bioethics, being human is irrelevant to moral status. What right. matters is if you're a person. And in that, in this formulation, being a person is a cognitive question. Are you self-aware over time, et cetera, et cetera? Can you enjoy your own life? This kind of thing. That means that human beings who either have not developed those capacities because of, let's say, immaturity, or have had them denigrated or deconstructed because of injury or illness, have less value. This is the end of human equality. This is the end of universal human rights. And this whole idea about you sign an advance directive that you want to be killed if you become incapacitated says that the person, when they're incapacitated, doesn't have the have equal value to the same human being when they were not incapacitated. And you even have people like Pope, who is a very prominent bioethicist, travels the world preaching this stuff, saying that caregivers should be forced to not even spoon feed somebody with dementia if they had so requested before they became incapacitated. In other words, forcing caregivers to starve people to death. Can you imagine?
The horror of it all is compounded by the fact that it's not just in the medical sphere that we're seeing this. We're seeing this language now greatly permeate the popular culture. If you don't mind me yes. just mildly shifting gears, the horrendously obtuse statements that Kilmeade made about just kill mentally ill homeless individuals who refuse help. Again, you know, like you mentioned, the fact that it's a human person doesn't necessarily equate into dignity under this moral calculus.
And what Kilmeade said was this: they were talking about the murder of that poor Ukrainian woman in North Carolina.
Yeah, yeah.
And by a mentally ill homeless man. And his co-host, Lawrence Jones, said something to the effect of either they accept help or they go to jail. And then Kilmeade replied, or involuntary lethal injection or something, you just kill them. I was appalled. People who are homeless, whether they have mental illnesses, whether they have addictions, or whether they're just down and out, are still equal human beings of equal human dignity. And the way we help people who are homeless, I think, is certainly subject to debate, but that their intrinsic value is equal is not subject to debate.
Right.
And so I wrote a piece on National Review Online about this, and eventually, and a few other people did too, and I'm not saying it was because of my article, but he did a terse apology.
Yeah.
But if you listen to the apology, it was like he was having his tooth pulled. It was not a heartfelt, you know, I was yeah. caught up in the emotion of this poor murdered woman, which we could all understand. It was, I guess I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah.
And, but it was really appalling.
But you see, Wes, even with the apology, it was very clear that the callousness was still prevalent, because the narrative here is, he doesn't actually believe he did anything morally wrong. Meanwhile, you're making an argument for human dignity from an ontological level. Natural law dictates human person equals inherent dignity.
Yes, and so does human equality. If you do not have equal moral worth, regardless of capacities or your, in terms of your standing, that one can be punished for what someone does. But that doesn't change that they're a human being. That's why you don't draw and quarter people anymore, right? You know, right. There are certain things you don't do to people because they're people.
Right.
And that is what needs to be reemphasized, because the entire edifice of human equality and human rights depends on it.
And that's, again, switching back to our earlier conversation about this constant push for assisted suicide and euthanizing individuals with dementia, there's so much that can be morally learned in terms of forming society, not just in compassion, mind you, but also in human exceptionalism, in caring for those of our members who are suffering. And we yes. rob ourselves of this because we just want to eradicate them as if they're the problem.
Yeah, we put them out of our misery. Do I have time to tell a story of something that happened?
You've got 1 minute. Go ahead.
Well, there was a woman who was diagnosed with dementia, and mm-hmm. she signed a declaration in the Netherlands saying, if I become incapacitated, I want to be killed. However, I want to decide. Her doctor kept coming to her saying, you want to kill? Should I kill you now? Should I kill you now? And she would always say, oh, let's not go there. The doctor actually came to the home, drugged the woman, drugged her coffee. She became unconscious, started the lethal injection. The woman woke up, started to struggle, and the family held her down while she was killed. That's what you end up with. And then the parliament, instead of making sure that never happened again, actually legalized what the doctor did.
And that is exactly what you and I are talking about, because the Hippocratic Oath is gone, and so an essential moral framework, let alone a calculus, for the operations of medical professionals is simply out the window. You and I have to be the corrective now.
Well, we have to scream and yell from the rooftops.
Yep.
because people are growing either tired of all of the fuss, right? They just say, leave me alone. Do what you want, just leave me alone. The problem is they're not going to leave you alone. And we have to stand up for righteousness. And this is a destruction of righteousness.
Yep. And so as we round off this conversation, Wes, I want to say, first of all, thank you very much for making the time. But second of all, thank you for constantly being at the forefront of fighting for human dignity, especially in these bioethics spheres.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
My guest has been Wes Smith, Chair and Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute's Center on Human Exceptionalism. We've been talking about the continued rise, unfortunately, of pushes for dementia, euthanasia, assisted suicide, and why that's detrimental to society at large, but also an affront to the dignity of the persons involved. I'm Marcus Peter.
The Encounter School of Ministry main campus is offering the first three classes as a come and see opportunity. If you desire to hear God's voice more clearly, have confidence in praying for healing, or sharing the gospel, the Encounter School draws from the richness of our Catholic faith to teach you to demonstrate God's love through the power of the Holy Spirit. Come and see, September 8th, 15th, and 22nd at St. Patrick's in Brighton. Praise and worship begins at 5 p.m., with classes starting at 6. Visit EncounterCatholic.com to learn more.
Every woman deserves specialized health care. At Arbor Women Health, our team of compassionate professionals listen to our patients and want to understand what they're going through. They serve everyone from teen girls to seniors. Our faith-based clinicians specialize in obstetrics, gynecology, fertility awareness in crisis, or unexpected pregnancies. Call 734-930-4020 or visit arborwomenhealth.org. Arbor Woman, faith-inspired, dignity-affirming healthcare.
Remember to take a minute this week to thank a priest you know for all the blessings he shares through his vocation. Let us encourage them and express our gratitude for all of their sacrifices. Saying something like, thank you for baptizing our children. Nominate your priest at thankyouforyourpriesthood.com. A new contest every month through September 2025, brought to you by Diocesan, your Catholic advertising and communications company.
Hi, it's Teresa Tomeo from Catholic Connection. Not having a will puts an unnecessary burden on your children. At MyCatholicWill.com, a legal will is as simple as 15 minutes filling out information about your family. The standard cost, only $79.95. However, thanks to our partnership with MyCatholicWill.com, when you use a promo code AVE, that's A-V-E, your will is absolutely free. No hidden costs whatsoever. So visit MyCatholicWill.com.
Food for the Journey, Sister Ann Shield.
Sometimes people will say to me, I try to follow God, but it's just too hard, or it's just too much, or I don't hear Him, or I don't know Him. And I always ask the question, how much time do you spend with Him? How much time do you give God? Even if you start out giving God 15 minutes a day, first thing in the morning if you can, but 15 minutes a day, read His Word, read the scripture readings for the Mass that day. But read His Word and ask God to speak to your heart, and He's going to draw you to Himself. No wonder we're so harried and so distressed in so many ways. And I know there are external things, but when we trust the Lord, when we know we're not alone with our difficulties, we find a peace. Even in the middle of the storm, we can find a peace because God will share His own life with us. Really urge you, brothers and sisters, please, make God the center of your life, the center of your priorities. Let him be the determining factor for what you do, what you don't do, what your relationships are like. Let him be the determining factor, and you're going to know a peace and a happiness that the world, and no matter what the world throws at us, will not be able to take away from you.
Food for the Journey with Sister Ann Shields can be now heard on the audio archives page at AveMariaRadio.net.
At Glass Doctor, our trained specialists are experts at fixing foggy and cracked glass, leaving any residential window looking like new without replacing the entire window. Bring back the view of any window with Glass Doctor. Visit GlassDoctor.com to request a free estimate on repairing your foggy or cracked windows. Let Glass Doctor bring back your view.
Call the Glass Doctor, we'll fix your paint. Oh yeah!
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. 15 years ago this month, Pope Benedict XVI became the first pope to make a state visit to Britain. And in doing so, he went to no less than Westminster Hall and delivered the great Westminster Hall address that we remember today. During this visit, he preached on the role of the laity, the relationship between faith and reason, and it's unironic, actually, it was deliberate that this was delivered at Westminster Hall. We'll talk more about this with Stephen White. Stephen is a fellow in the Catholic Studies program at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and he has recently authored in The Catholic Thing, When the Pope Went to Westminster. Stephen, thank you so much for making time again. How are you?
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Marcus. I'm well.
So, I know we have a lot to cover and very little time to cover it, because this was yet again one of those gargantuan moments in the history of Western civilization. If you might humor us by providing us the historical context that makes the Westminster Address so pivotal.
Yeah, well, it's a big deal when the Bishop of Rome is invited for a state visit to the United Kingdom. This was the first time this had ever happened. Now, popes had visited the UK before, but as an apostolic visit, so John Paul II went. But for the British government to formally invite as a state visit the Bishop of Rome, the Pope, was a big deal. If you know anything about English history, about 500 years ago, things sort of went south. England was one of the sort of the crowns of the sort of crown jewels of the Catholic world, and Henry VIII famously put an end to that. And so you had this falling out and terrible persecutions of Catholics under Elizabeth and Edward, and there's a long and ugly history of the relationship between the Catholic Church and England, especially over the last 500 years. So to have the Pope, who sort of was the one who Henry VIII blamed for his troubles and his lack of an heir and his inability to divorce and remarry, have the Pope invited on a state visit. That in itself, if nothing else happened, that was a momentous occasion. That he was asked to give an address to sort of representatives of civil society, so this is political leaders and such, in Westminster Hall, the very same room where the trial of St. Thomas More took place. So the stage was set for an address sort of pregnant with all kinds of historical implications.
By the time Pope Benedict XVI was visiting, the English Reformation that had marked England from that point on with a very vehement anti-Catholicism, it was virtually ingrained into English identity from that point on, it had begun to wane. And so it was a prophetic and prescient moment that Pope Benedict XVI was able to enter into the culture and speak in that way and say boldly what he did say.
Yeah, and he chose his words carefully. You know, the heart of the address was about the role of religion in public life, right? The relationship between faith and reason. And he might have been expected to come and deliver remarks about the importance of religious freedom, about allowing space in public life for religion or for minority religions, right? It's better when Catholics in England are just a minority but are left alone rather than persecuted the way they were hundreds of years ago. But that's not quite what he did. He's in favor of all of those things, of course, of you know, peace and religious freedom. But he came and he delivered a bit of a different address, which is to say that religion is not something to be politely tolerated, but that it is in fact necessary. It's a necessary corrective to a view of the world that's overly dependent on reason, because there are parts of human life, human longing, that mere reason cannot address. And that if we try and rely only on sort of pure reason, we're going to have a stunted view of ourselves and of the world, and we're going to go astray. And religion provides a necessary corrective to that, so that religion is not just something that polite people in the modern world can tolerate, but it's something without which we will go astray.
Right.
Not just in our sort of moral behavior, but in our understanding of ourselves and who we are as people and what we ought to be about as a society. So he was making a much more substantive and bolder claim than simply saying, you know, we're glad that the Catholics and Protestants aren't killing each other in the British Isles anymore. he was sort of making a full-throated defense of the necessity of religion for the success of public life.
If I may be so bold as to ask you to expand that, because what you're touching on is he's not just saying religion is necessary for the operations of sound public affairs and public life. He's also effectively saying that no religion, your reason becomes completely corrupted in the public square.
Yeah, and he goes both ways, right?
Yeah.
So if you live as if the spiritual realities of human life don't matter to how we live together, how we live as individuals, or how we live together, you're taking a stunted view of the human person and of human society. And there are aspects of human life, the most important aspect, I would say, is that, for which our mere reason is simply inadequate. There are aspects of the reality of being a human person which only make sense in the light of faith. And so an attempt to organize society or to set rules for human cohabitation that ignore the light of faith is going to be a clouded and diminished vision of the human person and human society. And
right.
So that's, in that context, he says that faith has to be a corrective to our reason, to teach us and help us to see things that our reason alone can't see. But he makes a further point, and he says reason is a necessary corrective to faith also, that a blind faith, a faith that ignores reason, a faith that thinks that reason is just corrupts faith and faith can exist and flourish and be sort of healthy without the use of reason, is a mistake too. A kind of fundamentalism which is blind to the gift of reason that we were given, is another dangerous error. It may be less a less common error, perhaps among sort of polite society in the British Isles. But I think he was saying that we have to avoid both mistakes. And the purpose for his visit, or what sort of the highlight of his visit to the UK that year, was the beatification of now St. John Henry Newman. And so he leaned into these themes of faith and reason, which Newman was such a champion of the sort of the right understanding of faith and reason, and how they mutually reinforce one another. They're not, you can't have a deficit of one will harm the other. So
you threw out
tidy thematic
information. And he threw out that sentence that was, frankly, very jarring and tremendously powerful in the Westminster Address, that religion becomes the corrective for the exercise of reason in the public sphere. And if you could also just speak to, I know we're running out of time in this segment, but the fact that reason needs to be constantly purified lest it go off rampant by itself.
Yeah, there are plenty of examples in the 20th century alone of sort of attempts to purportedly scientific attempts to remake the human person.
Mm-hmm.
This took sort of nasty forms in the totalitarian regimes of Nazism and also communism,
mm-hmm.
Where we're going to set aside the old superstitions and just use science to try to remake man in our own image. That was a terrible thing, and many, many people died and many lives were ruined. But there, having moved beyond those kinds of totalitarianism, there's a temptation today to think of ourselves in the same way, not because we want to be totalitarian, but we think we can sort of use our science and our reason to figure things out. But without the light of faith, there's no hope for that.
My guest is Stephen White, fellow in the Catholic Studies program at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. We are talking about Pope Benedict XVI's legendary Westminster Address, that we may be conversant about it and know what he was trying to address and learn from it. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Women from across Michigan are invited to come together to focus on their faith and experience the fellowship of sisterhood in Christ Jesus. It all takes place at the Michigan Catholic Women's Conference Saturday, October 11th. Throughout the day, women will be encouraged and inspired to ignite their spirits and grow their faith by hearing from Catholic speakers, engaging in praise and worship music, as well as celebrating Holy Mass with our bishops. Go to MichiganCWC.org today.
On the next Epiphany.
Hi, Vanessa Denha-Garmo here. Becky Loveland will be here to tell us all about the Michigan Catholic Women's Conference taking place October 11th at the Lansing Center in Lansing. Speakers include Father Matthias Thalen, Sherry Wolfert, and Aaron Luby Carlson.
Epiphany, weekdays at noon. And be sure to catch past episodes in our archive at AveMariaRadio.net.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchuk.
How do we raise faithful kids? Well, the answer is surprising. Make the faith the source of the warmth in your home. 50 years of research involving thousands of families has shown that the single most important way to increase the likelihood that children will own their faith as adults is to let them experience the practical difference their faith makes in their daily family lives. Kids who grow up in homes where the practice of their faith makes their households more peaceful, more loving, more joyful, are much more likely to practice their faith as adults. Why? Because for kids especially, faith is only real if they can see it being lived out at home and producing good fruit in their relationships at home. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchuk, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
The Heart of the Interior Life with Elizabeth Jingle.
In the 14th rule of St. Ignatius of Loyola's 14 Rules for the Discernment of Spirits, St. Ignatius teaches that the enemy looks in turn at all of our theological, cardinal, and moral virtues, and where he finds us weakest and most in need for our eternal salvation, there he attacks us and attempts to take us. Once we have identified our weakest spiritual point, we can work to strengthen it. Father Timothy Gallagher writes, "People of discernment can prepare their resistance to these deceptions before the deceptions begin. They can learn where in their spiritual lives the enemy's deceptions are most likely to occur and prepare beforehand. If they do, the enemy may be blocked before he even begins his attack. This is the final refinement of discerning awareness, understanding, and resistance to which Ignatius would lead faithful people in these 14 rules."
For more information, visit AveMariaRadio.net.
What takes place during the sacrament that is called the anointing of the sick? According to the Catechism, when those who are ill are anointed with sacred oils, the Church commends them to the suffering and glorified Lord, in order that He may raise them up and save them. The Church exhorts the sick person to unite their sufferings to the passion and death of Christ. The Catechism acknowledges that illness and suffering are among the most difficult and serious problems that human beings confront. The patient faces his vulnerability, his powerlessness, and perhaps a glimpse of death. Illness can lead to anger, self-absorption, even revolt against God. On the other hand, it can and often does lead to a new spiritual maturity and a return to God. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
You're listening to Ave Maria Radio.
Ave Maria Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, talking with Stephen White. He is a fellow in Catholic Studies at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and we are talking about the Westminster Address of Pope Benedict XVI. So, Stephen, I want to pick up where we left off. Like you were mentioning earlier, when he delivered this address, he had also beatified Newman in Birmingham. And so, drawing from Newman's life legacy, but also the progression of his thought, was a kind of charitable corrective, if you will, to the way the faith had devolved in Anglicanism in England. I wonder if you could comment on that.
For those who don't know Newman, he was a very prominent Anglican priest before he converted. So his conversion and being made a cardinal caused quite a stir within England. This was sort of a not everyone, this didn't fit well with everyone in England.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that conversion was his grappling with, you know, what does it mean to be defend the rights of conscience when you're going to be, you know, swearing allegiance to the Pope. And so his wisdom in sort of threading this needle and evaluating how one can be faithful to one's conscience, but also faithful to religious authority, is a tremendous example for all of us. But he also had a real profound understanding of the importance of the laity. He was, mm-hmm. he was not just some sort of high flown intellectual. His work as a pastor had really, shaped him. And he spoke about, there's a quote that Benedict XVI used in a different address during that visit, but it's worth, I'm going to repeat it here. This is Newman talking about what he wants in the laity. He says, I want a laity, not arrogant, not rash in speech, not disputatious, but men who know their religion, who enter into it, who know just where they stand, who know what they hold and what they do not, who know their creed so well that they can give an account of it, who know so much of history that they can defend it. The idea that a well-formed laity is crucial, not just for the sake of the laity, but is crucial to the vitality of the church and to the Christian community as a whole. There's the church needs to expect a lot of the laity. The laity is not just there to pay, pray, and obey, as the, right. the saying goes. And I think that is, you know, if you combine that vision of the laity and the mm-hmm. role of the laity, a laity that is faithful and understands the importance of the light of faith, but also uses their reason, is practical and in the world in that sense. If you pair that with the concerns that Pope Benedict XVI was expressing in his address at Westminster Hall, you see sort of a challenge and an opportunity. At the time, Benedict XVI was warning about what happens to public life when religion is excluded,
right.
often in the name of tolerance, right? And what you get is a kind of, paradoxically, a discrimination against Christians. And the light of faith is not allowed to play this necessary corrective role on public life. And as hard as it might have been to believe 15 years ago, we see this playing out in life in the UK these days, where people are being arrested for praying silently, and arrested for politically incorrect tweets. The sense of justice has sort of become unmoored, particularly as it applies to religious things. I mean, imagine what kind of defense of human conscience or religious liberty allows for someone to be arrested for praying silently, perhaps even in their own home. This is a very bizarre and extreme sort of breakdown of where you can clearly see that the corrective light of faith is not having the purchase it should have. And so you have this situation where it's not enough to have a pope every now and then come and object to the absence of religion from public life.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't necessarily take a Newman, someone of his intellectual stature, as great as he is, What we really need is people who understand their faith, who know where they stand, what they hold and do not hold. We need the laity that Newman was speaking about. That's what we need. We need that sort of critical mass of people who understand and live their faith courageously and in and amidst the vicissitudes of everyday life. That kind of example sort of puts flesh on the bones. We can have the great guidance from our intellectual and spiritual leaders, but unless we find a way to live that life, to live that faith boldly and courageously in our everyday lives, the public space that so desperately needs the corrective light of faith is going to be deprived of it. And that's on us. It's on us, the laity, to be better at doing that, not just in the United Kingdom, but I think everywhere.
If I might, if you could please pardon the pun here, the critical mass of such a well-catechized laity should lead to, therefore, a mass of critically thinking laity who become the instrument of the church in engagement of religious thought and therefore rational thought, sound rational thought in the public sphere, which really is the core issue we are seeing right now, that it's the laity who seeded the ground of culture and formation to secularistic institutions. And so we wonder why the West is devolving.
Yeah, and I think this perhaps applies more here in the United States than it does in the UK, but there's a certain comfort that Catholic lay people, and I'm talking about people who are serious about their faith, there's a certain comfort we take in being able to blame the bishops for everything that goes wrong or that doesn't
happen.
It is an
American thing to do, yeah.
I wish the bishops would do something about this, or I wish the bishops would speak more clearly about that, or whatever. And that's good. I don't disagree with that. But, I look around the vineyard, so to speak, and the parts that are really sort of in disarray and disrepair that cause the most obvious sort of social unraveling are things like the family or, civil discourse in our politics. And those are primarily the domain of the laity. So, yes, we need our bishops. Yes, we need their help. And, yes, we need their leadership and guidance. But we can't wait for them to do it for us. They can't do it for us. It's our job. It's our vocation. It's part of the mission for which we were baptized, to go and be the leaven that we're called to be. That's not something we can sit back and say, yeah, this is a problem. And if the bishops had more courage, it wouldn't be a problem. Well, that's not really true. Yeah. Courage is always welcome, but I think we have to take seriously our vocation as lay people, because there's a lot of work to do and it can't be done by someone else.
And to also, to not belabor that point, but to also emphasize it, we can also acknowledge that, between their own workload, but also B, we have had throughout history bishops and or priests who, for one reason or another, have been unfaithful to anywhere from the call of the gospel to the work of bringing the gospel to the public square. And so it has always been incumbent upon the faithful of Christ to be the leaven in the world that really transforms culture and society.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think for most people, an honest assessment of how their own faith has come to be, how it's been strengthened, how it's been lived out, maybe some people, their primary influence in their faith and how they live life was from their bishop. But for most of us, it comes from family, right? We learn the faith first in our families. Usually we live out our faith mostly in the presence and the company of other lay men and women. That's not to diminish the necessary importance of our priests and our bishops. But so much of what, how we come to learn the faith, understand it, and how we live it out happens in places where our priests and bishops aren't. And maybe sometimes where our priests and bishops can't really go. They can't be in our workplaces or in our businesses every day. That's for us. And so we have to take that seriously. We can't just sort of sit back and wait for someone else higher up to do the job. I think it's a fundamental misunderstanding of what it means to be baptized, right? That we are all called to be missionaries in that regard. It doesn't mean that everything we say and do is a kind of proselytizing, but it does mean that we have to bring faith with us to every aspect of our lives. It's not just something for Sundays. It's not just something for private. It's something that we live fully and earnestly, wholeheartedly in every aspect of our life.
Could you also speak to just how powerful a warning the Westminster Address was at the point it was given for us today. It's again one of those times where I believe Ratzinger was being so prophetic that we were so close to it, we didn't see it, and now in hindsight we realize, my goodness, he was giving us a diagnosis and a prescription, and we just didn't take it.
Yeah, this theme of the relationship between faith and reason and the relationship between truth and freedom are central themes for his entire pontificate. And I think it's worth going to, you can find the whole text online. It's online at the Vatican website. It's worth reading. It's not terribly long. But the themes he picks up on are themes that he spoke about often. This theme of the need for not only faith to be a corrective for reason, but for reason to be is necessary for understanding faith properly. That was a theme of his Regensburg address that he got mm-hmm. a lot of trouble for criticizing certain strands of Islam that fail in that measure, as he saw it. And there's a sense in which without the light of faith as a corrective to reason, and without recognizing that reason can identify some objective realities about how we ought to behave and how we ought to treat one another, what happens is not a situation where in the name of tolerance we banish religion from public life, but what ends up happening is we've sort of eliminated the possibility of identifying a truth that we can all recognize. So in the name of tolerance, we've not eliminated conflict, but we've eliminated the possibility of reconciliation. That was at the heart of his dictatorship of relativism. Yeah. So a lot of these themes come back over and over, and they bear rereading time and again.
Yep, I couldn't agree more. Stephen, thank you very much for opening all of that for us. My guest has been Stephen White, fellow in the Catholic Studies program at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. And Stephen is issuing us a caution. Take Ratzinger's exhortation seriously, or the West will perish.